Can I take your listeners back with me for a minute to 1918, which was a time just after World War I, when America and Britain and much of the rest of the world was quite poor. There were everything from food shortages to gasoline shortages. And I want to take them to a small town in the state of Maine. And maybe some of your listeners will recognize the town of Freeport, Maine, because it's the home of one of the most famous mail order catalog companies in the world, the famous L.L. Bean Company. And back then, there was no such thing as catalog companies, and what there was in the town of Freeport, Maine, was not much money and not much opportunity. There were also not many blacks. In fact, there were no blacks who lived in this town of Freeport, Maine. And every day after school, the young kids would take a makeshift baseball field that they put together next to the town hall, and this was their entertainment. They'd do it in the summer, they'd do it in the spring and fall, and they'd even do it in the winter when they painted their baseball yellow so they could see it when it got hit out into a pile of snow. And every day they'd go out there and they'd have this wonderful game as soon as the school bell rang and they were out of class. One day they were out there playing this game, and a young boy named Hank Sewell hit a towering shot up over second base, and it was a ball that went so high in the air it looked like it might never come down. Well, I mentioned this was a makeshift baseball field, and out just beyond second base, there were train tracks running from Boston to a train that went all the way to Nova Scotia in Canada. And this train went right beyond second base. And this day, when Hank Sewell hit his high fly ball, when it came down, it happened to come down in a magical moment when the train was just going by through their baseball field. And there was a black man standing on the observation deck of that train as it went by. And just as the ball came down to earth, this black man stuck out his hand and he grabbed the baseball. And these young boys, if you can imagine, this is a town with zero blacks in a state with literally a handful of African Americans in the entire state of Maine, which was well north in America. They watched this black man catch the ball and they were in awe. They thought it was magic. Then they watched him continue on in his train ride with their baseball in his hand.
And they thought he nicked it.
They thought that he nicked it. And these were young boys who, that baseball was something that when it got beat up, they'd take it down to the local auto parts store and they'd tape up the baseball. They, affording a baseball was not something that came easy to these boys in that town, in that era in America. So they were very angry and they did two things. Number one is they all pitched in with their pennies and they went down to the local dry goods store, the L.L. Bean, a little dry goods store in their town, and they bought a new baseball. And the second thing is they wrote a letter to the Pullman Company and they said essentially, give us back our baseball. They said this black Pullman porter came along and he took our baseball and we never saw it again.
And what happened?
So about a month later, the kids are back there playing with their new baseball in their baseball field next to the town hall. And the same train is coming through, and the same tall black man in his elegant blue uniform is standing on the observation deck. And he tosses the boys a baseball. Now, I don't know if any of your listeners are American baseball fans, but the longest-suffering team in the history of American baseball was a team known as the Boston Red Sox. And the last time the Boston Red Sox, until the last few years, the last time the Boston Red Sox had won the ultimate championship called the World Series was back in 1918 when they had a very famous outfielder and pitcher named Babe Ruth. And when these kids got this baseball, the Pullman porter tosses it to them. They look at the baseball and they see the names of a lot of their favorite players on the Boston Red Sox. There was a guy named Deacon Scott, who was a Red Sox shortstop. There was a catcher named Wally Shang. And there was, best of all, a guy named George Herman Ruth, who they knew as the Babe. And all of these guys from the championship, the World Championship 1918 Boston Red Sox, had signed the baseball that the Pullman porter threw back to them. These kids were in heaven. Now, nearly 100 years later, that baseball sits in the most cherished spot in the town hall in Freeport, Maine, the autographed baseball that today would be worth a couple $1 million. And to these kids back then, it was worth even more. Every day for the next month, when that train pulled through their town, this tall black Pullman porter would toss them another baseball, half of which had autographs of their favorite ball players on it. To me, there are two interesting things about that story. One is that to these young boys, like to much of white America throughout the entire century, from the end of the Civil War in the 1860s until the 1960s, the only image they had of a black man was this Pullman porter who they either saw on the railroad car or who they saw drive through their town on a train the way these young boys did. He was an image of dignity. He was an image of elegance. He was an image of the one black man that had ever come into their lives, the Pullman porter. That's what the Pullman porter looked like to white America. What was interesting to me is that these young boys, while they were in awe of what happened with this man, nobody ever thought to ask who he was or where he came from. The image to white America was of, as I mentioned, of elegance and of dignity, but it was also one of anonymity. He was almost part of the furniture in George Pullman's sleeping car. They never had a sense that he was a human being. In the case of this particular Pullman porter, that he happened to live about 20 miles away from them in Freeport, Maine. He was one of the few blacks who lived in Maine back then, that he had kids of his own, that he had an entire family of Pullman porters who came before him and after him. They never knew any of that, just like the passengers who rode on George Pullman's sleeping cars never thought to ask anything of the Pullman porters who took care of them. They knew they were great servants. They knew they could be trusted, and that's all they felt like they had to know.
For your information, most of our listeners, I'm sure, know about the curse of the babe that the Boston Red Sox have suffered for many years, so don't worry about that. But from what you tell us of the Pullman porter, for his family at least, it must have seemed like, you know, the young student going off to university, and by the time he comes home, he's a different person to his parents. And certainly the Pullman porter, after generations of working 400 hours a month, earning $10 a month, soon changed, didn't he? And he wanted more, and more of a recognition of who he was.
He did want more of a recognition, and thankfully for the Pullman porters, a guy named A. Philip Randolph came along and helped give them that recognition. A. Philip Randolph was a guy who had a very interesting history. He was a socialist. He was from the Deep South. He was a wonderfully educated man who had a track record of failure in everything he had tried to do. He had tried to organize ship workers and develop a union for these guys who were doing the ships that cruised the American waterways. He had tried to organize hotel workers and elevator operators. He had essentially failed in everything he had tried to do. And the Pullman porters had a long history of trying to organize. They had seen the way white America worked. They understood the opportunities they were given and the opportunities they were denied. And for about 30 years, they had tried to organize a union. And George Pullman, every attempt they made to organize a union, he did them one better in crushing their union. He did it sometimes by undermining them, by getting black ministers, giving them bribes so that they would go to the pulpit and argue against the Pullman porters forming a union. He did it by hiring thugs. He did it by any means that he had to keep them from becoming organized. A. Philip Randolph was even more stubborn than George Pullman was, and after a long 10-year struggle where he was beaten up, where he was humiliated, where he had tried everything that he could to organize these workers, after a very long struggle, he finally succeeded in getting them a union. It was the first successful union for blacks in the history of America. And it was quite an extraordinary achievement that this guy who had never ridden in a Pullman sleeping car, had barely ever ridden on a train himself, came in and just by force of character and by understanding how important a union could be for these Pullman porters, he got them this extraordinary organizing tool that changed their lives.
And although the story of the Pullman porters hasn't quite come full circle, we shouldn't forget the irony in all of this, that the slogan that Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves and George Pullman hired the slaves has now come back on itself, because isn't it Abraham Lincoln's son who is responsible for firing the slaves?
It was. When George Pullman understood that he was nearing his death, he realized that his kids were not capable of taking over his company, so he trained this young man, Robert Todd Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln's son, to be his successor as president of the Pullman Company, and he trained him in the ways of the business world, in all the services that he was offering on the train, and how brilliant that was. He also trained him in the importance of crushing any attempt of any of his workers, and certainly of his black Pullman porters, to form a union. George Pullman had a reputation of doing more to subvert unions by any of his workers. One of the most famous strikes in the history of the American labor movement was the Pullman strike by white Pullman workers who built and ran the sleeping cars. And George Pullman, with substantial violence, by calling in the militia in the state of Illinois, crushed that attempt to form a union. He was even more determined that his black workers would never violate what he felt was his trust in them by forming a union. He inculcated his successor, Robert Todd Lincoln, in that way of fighting against the union, so that the expression that the Pullman porters had was, Abe Lincoln freed the slaves and his son Robert Todd re-enslaved them with a form of industrial slavery. It was, however, under Robert Todd Lincoln that A. Philip Randolph developed this union, and Robert Todd Lincoln had no choice in the end but to either accept the union or lose his brilliant Pullman porter workers.
But the irony is that in terms of rail travel, after the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Attendants, the union, managed to get recognised and get better conditions for its workers, the heyday of rail travel in America was beginning to ebb away, and there was actually less work for them after the union got recognition.
The good news was that they held on to the jobs. The bad news was that there weren't new jobs created, and as car travel became easier for people, much simpler, rather than traveling 3 days across country in a Pullman sleeping car, to take a plane that could get you there in a matter of hours. Much more convenient, rather than having to go from city to city in a train, to go from point to point just where you wanted to go, in the 1950s particularly, in this massive new highway construction program that President Eisenhower had launched in America. And the sad thing was that just as Pullman porters really started enjoying the fruits of their new union, their higher wages, their much greater dignity that they enjoyed, as they started enjoying these fruits, they also saw the jobs starting to wither away as train travel in America withered away.
You say sad, but actually they picked up the winds of change as they traveled, crisscrossed America on the trains, and they knew, as did many other Americans, that civil rights was right round the corner, and they played a crucial part. Your book is subtitled The Pullman Porters and the Making of the Black Middle Class. So you say that they're crucial to it, but one Pullman or former Pullman porter in particular was a central figure in the civil rights movement.
Yes, great. Can I, again, take your listeners back to Montgomery, Alabama in the mid-1950s? That's the heart of the old Confederacy, the former capital of the southern states of America when they fought the North in the Civil War. And what happened in 1954 in Montgomery, Alabama was a young woman named Rosa Parks was riding on a bus, and the standard law in writing and in practice across all of the South back then was that when a white passenger came on board a bus, blacks would have to move to the back of the bus, and they'd have to continue moving to the back and stand up from their seats as more white passengers came on to ensure that every white could sit down. This woman, Rosa Parks, had spent a long day at work. She was very tired, and when a white passenger came and expected to have her seat, she didn't give it up. And in fact, she had been trained by some of the early civil rights leaders in America what would happen next. And what would happen next is she knew that she would be arrested, and she was. She was taken to jail, and she was allowed a single phone call. And rather than calling somebody her husband or anybody else to come and get her down there, she called the man that she had worked for, and his name was E.D. Nixon, Edgar D. Nixon. And she knew Nixon and called him because she had worked for him. He ran the local office in Montgomery of a group called the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the primary civil rights group in America back then. But he actually wore two hats. He was a Pullman porter, and in addition to being a civil rights leader with the NAACP, he was also the head of the local Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, the union that A. Philip Randolph had founded, and he was a top lieutenant of Randolph's. Nixon had been waiting for this moment, for the perfect test case to challenge the system of segregation on buses and to use that as a way to challenge a wider system of segregation in America. And Nixon came down with Rosa Parks' husband, bailed her out of jail, and the next morning he picked up the phone and he called a dozen of the leading ministers, the leading black ministers in Montgomery, Alabama. And one of the early ones he called, because this was a young guy who had the largest church in Montgomery, was a young minister named Martin King, Martin Luther King Jr. And he said, "Reverend King, we're planning tomorrow to organize a group of ministers to meet to talk about what to do about Rosa Parks and to organize a boycott of blacks on the buses of Montgomery until they are desegregated, until they're integrated." And this young Reverend King was a little worried. He knew this guy Nixon was a rabble-rouser, and he said, "Look, Reverend Nixon, can I get back to you? I'm not sure whether I want to come to that meeting." Nixon proceeded to call all the leading ministers in Montgomery, and then he called Reverend King back, and he said, "Reverend King, have you thought about it?" And King said, "Yeah, I've thought about it. Okay, I'll come to your meeting." And Nixon said, "Well, that's great, because I've invited all the other ministers tomorrow at noon to be at your church." Now, the point of this is that the obvious guy to organize this bus boycott in Montgomery was Edgar D. Nixon, but he had the problem that he was a Pullman porter and he was away so much on the trains that he couldn't be there at every meeting. So he picked the perfect puppet, a smart young minister who he knew he could pull the strings of behind the scenes, and that was Martin Luther King Jr.
So your argument is that if it wasn't for Edgar D. Nixon, we wouldn't have had Martin Luther King Jr., the figurehead of the civil rights movement.
Yes, my argument is actually going a step before that. My argument is, if it wasn't for the Pullman porters and what they did, we wouldn't have had Edgar Nixon. If it wasn't for Edgar Nixon pulling in Martin King, we wouldn't have had the leader of the civil rights movement. And actually, that's not me making the argument. It's Martin King making it in his autobiography, crediting Nixon with this whole pulling him into the early civil rights movement. And my argument actually goes beyond that. My argument is, in its earliest days, the civil rights movement depended on the Pullman porters for several things. They gave the movement the earliest leadership it had with guys like A. Philip Randolph and Edgar Nixon, who had the history, the track record of having taken on the most powerful company in white America, the Pullman Company, and making them yield to a union. And they used those same leaders and those same arguments in rallying blacks and Americans generally to civil rights. They also, in the days when the civil rights movement had no money, it was the Pullman porters who used their union dues to finance the movement. So they gave them leadership, they gave them money, they gave them a place to meet. My argument is, were it not for the Pullman porters, the civil rights struggle in America would have had a much tougher time getting off the ground, and it would have eventually succeeded, but would have taken a whole lot longer. The Pullman porters were the backbone of the movement, and they never got credit for it, which to me is one of the very sad things in our short memory and our faulty understanding of our history.
What you also say is that it's the children and grandchildren of the Pullman porter, the dignified way in which he brought his children up and inculcated in them the sense of education and getting on in life, that has helped develop the black middle class in America.
Yes. I say that the Pullman porters gave us the first successful trade union. I say that they helped give us a civil rights movement. But I also say their most profound legacy was their children and their grandchildren, their nieces and their nephews, who the Pullman porters, through the money they earned on the trains, put through school, who they gave a sense of the opportunity that they could see among their white passengers but never experienced themselves. And it's not accidental that the first black Supreme Court justice in America, his father was a train porter and put himself through college, Thurgood Marshall put himself through college by working on the trains. That the first black mayor of a major American city, Tom Bradley in L.A., was the son of a Pullman porter. The first black mayor of San Francisco, Willie Brown, was the son of a Pullman porter. That across the history of black America, scientists and lawyers, doctors and community leaders were the children and grandchildren of Pullman porters, and that was the legacy they were most proud of and that most profoundly affected the shape of America, to the extent where today the idea that we're about to inaugurate a black president in America, I think, owes a lot to the legacy of the Pullman porters.
That was the question I was going to ask you. Would you go as far as to say that we wouldn't have Barack Obama in the White House if it wasn't for the Pullman porters?
I would go as far as to say that Barack Obama admits that he stood on the shoulders of guys like Tom Bradley and Thurgood Marshall and all the other black leaders who made it possible for him to do what he did. They came directly from the Pullman porters. I think Barack Obama would be the first one to say that it was the legacy of brave guys like the Pullman porter and their 100-year struggle who gave us the opportunity for him to do what he did in America. There were certainly 100 other factors, but one of the very important ones is these guys who opened up these chances, the Pullman porters.
When my father stopped going to school and he stopped his work as a worker on the Pullman line in Boston and Maine Railroad, he decided, as did his two brothers, to open their own businesses. They no longer wanted to work for other people in servant-type jobs. My uncle Victor, who was older than my father, he finished University of Vermont and was the first person in the family to receive a bachelor's degree. My father opened up a beer and wine store. He always encouraged me to go to college. Big deal. If you came from a family like this, you're going to college. Whether you want to, whether you think your grades are good enough, we will find some college for you to go to. You will go to college and you will finish and then you will work. After that, maybe you get married. Although my father and mother didn't say that to me in those words, the expectation was there. My parents didn't nag me or anything. I knew that was just a part of who I was. From all the stories, from everything, this was the expectation.
To Niagara in a sleeper, there's no honeymoon that's cheaper, and the train is through. Off we go and shuffle off to Buffalo. Someday the stork may pay a visit and leave a little souvenir, just a little cute. What is it? But we'll discuss that later, dear. For a little silver quarter, we can have the Pullman party, turn the lights down low. Off we go, shuffle off to Buffalo.
Shuffle off to